Chapter 7, A 99% Improvement. In April 2003, I was scanning political stories on my laptop when I noticed the profile of Minnesota Senator Norm Coleman in Roll Call, one of the Capitol Hill dailies. It was the first profile of Coleman, who had been in office just a little over 3 months. According to Roll Call, Norm had already become, quote, an emerging star on the GOP's rubber chicken circuit. I read on. Most of it is because of beating Mondale, said Coleman, as he gesticulated his points with an unlit cigar in his new Hart office. Huh. As someone who had only ever gesticulated with an unlit cigar to make fun of people who gesticulate with unlit cigars, I got the impression that maybe Norm's ascent to the world's greatest deliberative body had gone to his head a bit. Then I read the sentence that would change my life. To be very blunt, and God watch over Paul's soul, I am a 99% improvement over Paul Wellstone. I am a 99% improvement over Paul Wellstone. I'm sorry, but you don't say that about anyone who died within the last 6 months. And my God, you don't say it about a guy who everyone agreed was a compassionate, tireless champion of the little guy, a loving husband and father, and a colleague whom every senator recognized for his passion and decency. Until that exact moment, I had never, ever considered running for political office. But when I read that quote on the Roll Call website, my immediate thought was, somebody's got to beat this guy. Except I didn't think exactly that. Instead of guy, I thought jerk. Except I didn't think that either. It was something else. I can't say it on this audio. But it's not as bad as you might think. Okay, it was bastard. No, it wasn't, but it was worse than that. Fine, it was dingus. Somebody's got to beat this dingus. That's what I thought. Now, that's a really bad reason to run for office, and over time it would become less and less about beating Norm Coleman and more about the people of Minnesota. By the time I clobbered him on Election Day, in the narrowest clobbering in political history, I had almost forgotten that the germ of the idea to run had come from such a petty place. And anyway, at the time I didn't think that the somebody who was going to beat this guy would end up being me. True, for a brief moment, I did find myself considering the fact that Franny and I were about to be empty nesters. Our son Joe was about to head off to college next year. It would be easy for us to move back to Minnesota and explore the idea. Then again, being an empty nester is not a good reason to run for the Senate either. It is, however, a great reason to take up a new hobby, such as gardening or paddle tennis, which can help ward off depression. In any event, I quickly set the thought aside. After all, I reminded myself, first I have to finish this book, and then I've committed to doing a 3-hour radio show 5 days a week. How's that for exposition? See, I was reading the article while sitting in my office at the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, where I was a fellow. When I accepted the position, I thought I was going to be a teaching fellow, but I wasn't. I was just a fellow. They told me, however, that I could lead a study group on any subject I wanted. I asked if it was okay if I taught students how to research a satirical book on politics. They said sure. As it turns out, a lot of professors at Harvard teach students how to research their books. The book, which became Lies and Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, would argue that the right-wing media had created a right-wing echo chamber that often intimidates the mainstream media into reporting its distortions and outright lies. The centerpiece of the book would be a chapter detailing how the right had exploited the Wellstone Memorial, a long and boisterous event held shortly after his death and shortly before the 2002 election that reflected the deep passion that had animated Paul throughout his life, as well as the strong emotional connection so many people felt that they had had with him. Republicans had promptly seized the opportunity to paint the memorial as an inappropriately partisan event. The Coleman campaign and its allies lied about everything from the content of the eulogies to the audience's reactions, effectively hijacking Paul's memorial for their own selfish partisan purposes by falsely accusing Democrats of hijacking it for our own selfish partisan purposes. If you haven't read Lies, go find a bookstore near you, grab a copy off the shelf, and just read that chapter. Tell them Al sent you, and that I said it would be fine if you hung out in the aisle for half an hour reading without buying anything. Or, hell, get a coffee or an app or whatever it is they're selling to stay in business these days. I still feel strongly about this, and so do lots and lots of other Minnesota Democrats. Losing Paul was a crushing blow. Losing Paul and then watching Republicans lie about his memorial service for political purposes was adding a despicable insult to a still fresh injury, and watching their scheme succeed was dispiriting beyond words. To then see Norm Coleman immediately start bragging not just about how he ended Walter Mondale's political career, but about how he was a better senator than Paul because he was so loyal to the Bush administration, it was almost too much. That's why I had such a strong reaction to Coleman's 99% improvement line. And it's a part of the reason why, for me and for so many other Minnesota Democrats, my 2008 campaign would end up feeling like it was about more than just a Senate seat. As emotional and difficult as that Wellstone chapter was, the rest of the book was just fun. Team Franken did a lot of fact-checking on well-known conservatives like Ann Coulter, Dick Cheney, and Bill O'Reilly, who up until then had merely been suspected of being congenital liars. The book put to rest forever any doubt that they and many other prominent right-wingers were very much indeed lying liars. But even before the book came out, something interesting happened. Bill O'Reilly and Fox News sued me. It was really just a simple misunderstanding. O'Reilly and the Fox legal team apparently didn't understand that in America, satire is protected by the First Amendment, even if the object of the satire doesn't get it. In any event, Fox was literally laughed out of court. Literally, the New York Times headline read, "In courtroom, laughter at Fox and a victory for Al Franken." Aided by the free publicity generated by O'Reilly, Lies skyrocketed to the top of the bestseller list for months, selling over a million copies. Arianna Huffington told me, "It's as if Bill O'Reilly walked up to you and handed you a check for $1 million. Readers responded to my thesis that the right's complaints about a liberal media bias in the mainstream media was disingenuous right-wing fiddle-faddle. They also liked the way I took on Bush's policies and his poppycock claims like, "The vast majority of my tax cuts goes to those at the bottom." On the book tour that fall, once again, I kept hearing things like, "Finally, someone's taking it to these guys." It felt good, even when they were visibly intoxicated. And every so often, someone would come up to me and say, "Why don't you run for office?" Especially Minnesota, where people were already thinking ahead to 2008, when Norm Coleman would have to run for re-election. But I had other things on my mind. While researching Lies, I learned that 22% of Americans were getting their news from talk radio, which meant right-wing talk radio. Liberals had ceded the airways to Rush Limbaugh and the Rush Limbaugh wannabes, and also in those days, the band Linkin Park, which was getting a lot of airplay. But in March 2003, while I was still researching and writing the book, I had taken the plunge and committed to hosting a daily 3-hour progressive radio show. I quickly learned a few things about radio. Radio stations have formats. Classic rock is a format. Country is a format. Hot adult contemporary, whatever that means, is a format. Talk radio is not a format. Conservative talk is a format. Placing my show between Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, or between Mark Levin and Michael Savage, would have been like putting 3 hours of hip-hop on a station that otherwise carried a day of its polar opposite, hop-hip. So we had to invent a new format, progressive radio, and that meant creating an entire day of programming, and while we were at it, an entire national radio network called Air America. The concept for my show was simple. We would not try to be the mirror image of right-wing radio, but its opposite. My executive producer, Billy Kimball, put together a staff of researchers, writers, and producers. Catherine Lanfer, a seasoned journalist and a fixture at Minnesota Public Radio, came aboard as my co-host. And on March 31st, 2004, The Al Franken Show, then called the O'Franken Factor, in an effort to further irritate Bill O'Reilly, went live. This is Al Franken speaking to you from 30,000 feet under Dick Cheney's bunker, and this is Air America Radio. We have watched the right wing take over the Congress, White House, and courts, and as insidiously the airways. We need a great watchdog to track them, and until one comes along, I'll have to do. We lay down some basic rules right off the bat. No call-ins, no actors talking about politics. We call that the Tim Robbins rule. And while we did some stuff that was just funny for the sake of being funny, like when I played Strom Thurmond bragging about his sexual conquest, "Catherine, I screwed them all. Yes, you did. I screwed them all." Or when my old partner Tom Davis would come on as the CEO of a sketchy outfit called Accountants Without Borders. I also wanted ours to be a show that was serious about public policy. After all, as long as I would be committing to preparing for and doing a daily three-hour show, I might as well learn something. So we decided that our guests would be people who knew stuff. For example, you often hear people say that Elizabeth Warren was talking about income inequality before almost anybody else. Well, one of the places she was talking about it before almost anybody else was on our show. We'd have her on to discuss the 2005 bankruptcy bill, an outrageous handout to the credit card industry, conservative attacks on pensions and Social Security, and the general deterioration of the middle class. But the thing we talked about more than anything else was Iraq. Lies and the Lying Liars was already on the bookshelves by the time it became clear that Bush's administration's biggest lie wasn't about tax cuts. "There is no doubt," Dick Cheney had declared in the lead-up to the invasion, "that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt he's amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us." Cheney was lying. And it's still crazy to think that he and the president and so many others, including, for God's sakes, Colin Powell, just flat-out lied us into a war. Heck, I was in the process of finishing a scholarly masterwork about how they lied all the time, and even I didn't think they would lie us into a war. But by the end of 2003, it was obvious that anyone who had maintained even the barest shred of faith in the administration's integrity and basic decency had made a mistake. There were no weapons of mass destruction. Worse, it turned out that Bush et al. Hadn't just lied us into a war, they lied us into a disaster. That Christmas, I went to Iraq for the first time on a USO tour. USO tours are the best thing I've ever done. I've done seven now, four of them to Kuwait, Iraq, and Afghanistan. I would spend about 2 weeks doing shows with an eclectic group of entertainers, including NFL cheerleaders and extremely right-wing country stars like Daryl Worley. Franny knew I loved these tours, but one year she said to me in frustration, "You don't see Bill O'Reilly going on USO tours." "That's not fair, honey," I said. "He has no talent." Between shows, we'd hit the DFACS, dining facilities, three, four, five times a day. Walking with your tray, looking for a place to sit down, you could see who wanted to talk. I learned a tremendous amount on these USO tours. Later, as a senator, I'd go on to visit Afghanistan on a CODEL, where we'd meet with top officials, most of whom would tell us exactly what they were supposed to tell us. Traveling with the USO, you could learn a lot more from the privates, lieutenants, command sergeant majors, and one-stars shooting the breeze in the DFACS in between shows. Everyone had different points of view. Back then, truck drivers were beginning to get blasted with IEDs. Guys fighting outside the wire were a lot more on edge than guys inside the wire. In my first Middle East tour in 03, while we were on our first stop in Kuwait, troops found Saddam Hussein in a spider hole near his hometown in Tikrit. But even in the flush of capturing Saddam, the message we got was that Operation Iraqi Freedom was not going quite as planned. Adding to the cost, both in blood and treasure, was the waste, fraud, and abuse by military contractors during Iraq's reconstruction. Billions were being ripped off by shady contractors. work was not completed or on some projects never started. And the inability to replace the loss of key infrastructures, roads, electricity, water, and sewage, sent the country spiraling further into chaos. Everyone in Iraq was paying the price. So were American taxpayers, and so were our troops, often with their lives. Oh, and by the way, guess who was officially in charge of exposing and reining in waste, fraud, and abuse in Iraq? It's someone you may remember from earlier in this chapter. No, not Catherine Lanfer. It was Norm Coleman. The newly elected Coleman had been given the plum chairmanship of the hallowed Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, known as PSI. The chairman of PSI is the only United States senator with sole subpoena power. He can investigate anything he wants. Originally, PSI had been the Truman Committee in the lead up to and during World War II. Before the war, Harry Truman, then a senator from Missouri, personally drove around the country in his car to inspect training camps and found widespread mismanagement and downright theft. Because the committee saved millions and so strengthened our war effort, Truman made the cover of Time, and in 1944, FDR chose him as his running mate. Truman's committee did 432 separate hearings on waste, fraud, and abuse in war contracting. While Coleman was chairman of PSI, his committee did exactly 432 fewer hearings than Truman's on waste, fraud, and abuse in war contracting. I went back to Iraq with the USO each of the next three winters, and every time I went, it seemed like things were getting worse. And even on that first visit, it was clear that some basic problems were not being taken care of. In Kuwait, they divided us up to go to different bases around Iraq. I volunteered to go to Tikrit, Saddam's hometown, and they thought a potentially dangerous place to go. As we boarded our plane in Kuwait, a soldier took me aside and suggested that I should make sure I got a flak jacket equipped with modern Kevlar plates. The Vietnam-era flak jacket I was wearing, he said, wouldn't really stop a bullet. So when I got to Iraq, I should insist on upgrading to Kevlar. He emphasized the word insist. I nodded. Insist. I got it. When our plane landed in Baghdad, we were transferred quickly to a waiting helicopter for the flight to Tikrit. As I climbed in, I turned to an airman and said, I've been told to ask for Kevlar plates for my flak jacket. The airman said, we don't have any. Uh-huh, I said, but I was told to insist. Well, that's fine, but we just don't have them. There was an uncomfortable moment before I tried one last time. Okay, I'm insisting. I understand we don't have any. So off I went to Tikrit, supposedly the most dangerous place in Iraq, where fortunately I was not shot, and neither were the cheerleaders. This failure to properly equip and protect our troops would become an ongoing scandal. Right before I went on my third trip in 2005, it came out the troops in Kuwait were going to dumps in search of metal they could use to up-armor their own Humvees. In response to the outcry, Donald Rumsfeld famously said, "You go to war with the army you have, not the army you want." This was particularly galling since the date he said this was further from 9/11 than VJ Day was from Pearl Harbor. In preparation for that year's USO tour, I asked SNL to make a flak jacket out of a garbage can and wore it during my opening monologue at our show, saying, "We've got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is there aren't any cheerleaders this year. The good news is," pointing to my garbage can flak jacket, "I've got 100 more of these." The radio show had started with an explicit goal of defeating President Bush in his 2004 re-election campaign. We all worked really hard to take down a guy whom we already were pretty sure was one of the worst presidents in history, and we failed. So 2005 was a pretty dark time for progressives. Just as in 2016, a Republican had won a presidential election, despite things that to many of us seemed obviously disqualifying. In Bush's case, it was Iraq and not his entire life story and personality. And now conservatives had a lock on all three branches of the government, plus a lie-amplifying propaganda machine. But the political infrastructure we'd started to build during the campaign, David Brock's media watchdog group, Media Matters, the Center for American Progress think tank, and even Air America itself, was working to help the progressive movement regroup, get re-energized, and find a new direction. Right after he got reelected, President Bush promised to privatize Social Security. We stopped him. Despite Karl Rove's predictions of a, quote, permanent Republican majority, we were slowly figuring out how to fight back. We were getting better at debunking Fox News and learning how to counter the kind of smear campaign that Republicans had run to perfection in 2004, as well as generating powerful ideas of our own. When I first started writing about politics, I just wanted to prove that the right-wing figures who got under my skin were liars and frauds. I was in what I now think of as the get-it-off-my-chest phase of my political development. But now it felt like I was part of something bigger, a real movement to change the direction of the country. By the summer of 2005, I was working on the follow-up to Lies and Lying Liars, The Truth with Jokes. Except this time, instead of just making fun of the Bush administration's mouthpieces, I found myself focusing more on making the case against the Bush administration itself and its terrible policies. The last chapter of The Truth, a letter to my grandchildren named Hillary Brock and Joe III, flashed forward 10 years to October 2015, and I told what I hoped would be the story of the intervening decade, one in which Democrats would take back Congress in the 2006 midterms, changing the political landscape by offering a slew of great ideas and setting the stage for a Democratic president to be elected in 2008. Then we would pass all sorts of legislation, beginning with universal health care and an Apollo project for renewable energy, and continuing on to tackle tax fairness, public education, and increasing youth turnout by legalizing voting by AOL Instant Messenger, which I am told nobody uses anymore. Oh, and in this scenario, I would be elected to the Senate in 2008. I hadn't forgotten about the whole 99% improvement thing. And as a rock fell apart, Norm Coleman's failure to perform his oversight responsibilities was only making me more sure that somebody indeed had to beat this guy. But by now I was beginning to think that maybe, just maybe, that somebody should be me after all.